If you found the past couple of weeks rather taxing philosophically, I wish you the best of luck this week. I hope you've had your coffee and that extra hour of sleep is going to come in handy. Remember, we are going through arguments for God's existence and the consequence of those arguments. We're going to analyze whether or not they hold water. And if the arguments are in fact valid, what does that mean about God? What does that mean about me? What does that mean about the ways in which I should read specific passages of Scripture? Okay. Today, we're going to be in the ontological argument, originally articulated by Anselm of Canterbury in 1034 in his Proslogion. As a quick review, and this is why one of our previous weeks mattered, we talked about truth and why correspondence theory of truth is the predominant way that the West and Christianity have understood the world. Truth is that which objectively and accurately corresponds to reality. Week two, we talked about a definition of God that's really going to matter today. And God is this thing that is beyond the universe. He's this thing that is other than us. He's this thing that is bigger than us, greater than us, so on and so forth. The third week, we talked about cosmological argumentation for God, that the cosmos, the universe, is set up in such a way that it necessitates something to exist outside of the universe. And then last week we talked about teleological argumentation for God, intelligent design, that when you see things moving towards an intelligent end, things that are not intelligent of themselves, it suggests an intelligent designer to be behind those movements of unintelligent things towards intelligent ends. Okay? Ontology, ontos, Chuck, am I right about this? It literally means truth in Greek? Put a pin in that. That's why he has a PhD. ontology is the study of existence. So anytime you are doing work ontologically, you are in the study of existence. The ontological argument is going to be an argument concerning the existence of God based on the limited capacities of human thought. So here's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to read you the passage from Anselm of Canterbury. I'm going to then put it into my own words and my own syllogistic explanation. We're going to read a second passage from Anselm of Canterbury that does the exact same argument from the negative perspective. Then we're going to pause for a few minutes, ask if it holds water, and then I'll walk you through the three most famous objections to that argument. Sound good? All right. In Proslogion, Anselm says this: "Even a fool, when he hears of a being than which nothing greater can be conceived, understands what he hears, and what he understands is in his understanding. And assuredly that than which nothing greater can be conceived cannot exist in understanding alone. For suppose it exists in the understanding alone, then it can be conceived to exist in reality, which is greater. Therefore, if that than which nothing greater can be conceived exists in understanding alone, the very being than which nothing greater can be conceived is one in which a greater can be conceived. Obviously, this is impossible. Hence, there is no doubt that there exists a being than which nothing greater can be conceived, and it exists both in understanding and reality." Let me put it into my words. Premise number one: by the word God, we mean the greatest of all possible beings. Now, Anselm elsewhere in Proslogion is going to say this: that which nothing greater can exist. By the word God, we mean the end of the line. There is nothing bigger than him, greater than him. He is the ultimate of all possible beings. So far, so good. Okay. Number two, the idea of this God exists in the mind. In other words, in order for us to have a coherent conversation about God, we must understand at some level what we mean by the word God, which is why we did that week 3 weeks ago. So if I'm saying that God is the greatest of all possible beings. That necessarily means the understanding of that definition exists in my mind. Otherwise, I could not comprehend what I am saying. Is everybody with me? This is different. Hear me. This is different than a full comprehension of what it means to be the greatest of all possible beings. I'm simply saying right now that the idea of a greatest of all possible beings exists in the mind. Good with premise number two. Premise number three. Existence, and I'll explain this in 1 second, is greater than non-existence. So the way Anselm is going to word this is this. A greatest of all possible beings cannot simply exist in the mind, for it is greater to exist both in the mind and in reality than simply exists as an idea. Okay? So if God exists in the mind, the greatest of all things would also exist in reality. Otherwise, I can conceive of something greater. If God only exists in the mind, I can actually conceive of an idea that's greater, something that exists in the mind and in reality. So far, so good? Okay. If God is the greatest of all possible beings, the idea of God exists in the mind, existence is greater than non-existence. What's our therefore? If I can conceive of the idea of God, what? He must exist, right? So I'll do our good old-fashioned therefore. God exists. Okay. So I'll walk you through it one more time. This one's a bit different, right? If by the word God, I mean the greatest of all possible beings, and that idea exists in the mind, it is greater to exist both in the mind and in reality than simply exists in the mind. By the definition of premise number one, then, the therefore statement, God must exist, has to be true. Okay? All right. I'm going to read a second passage from Anselm while y'all are chewing on that. Anselm then, he seems to understand that this is going to come across as so simplistic, there's no way this can be true. Right? Because essentially what this boils down to is if you can think about God, God must exist. That sounds horrifically wrong on the surface. And yet, when we walk through the various premises behind the syllogistic therefore, when we walk through the premises of the logic individually, each premise makes sense, and then we get to the conclusion, we're like, no way that works. Anselm seems to conceive, or at the very least understand, that this is going to be the primary objection of his audience. So then he says this, God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived, and God assuredly exists so truly that it cannot be conceived not to exist. For it is possible to conceive of a being which cannot be conceived not to exist, and this is greater than one which can be conceived not to exist. Can I put this in simpler words? Deny the existence of something that doesn't exist. Seriously, do it. Why can't we? Why not?
Our brains don't. We can't come up with something that doesn't exist. Like it's a
pink dragon made of purple cotton candy. Like.
And yet, yeah. Why is that different? What is he doing?
He's taking combining from it. Other things.
He's combining that which previously exists, yes? Because the human mind is only capable of thinking about that which does exist. Now, we can combine certain things that do exist into imaginative ideas, yes? But Anselm is going to be of the opinion that humanity is incapable of denying the existence of something which does not exist.
Is it fair to say that's why things like C.S. Lewis and J.K. Rowling are so intriguing to us is because they're so able to bring that which is nearest to mm-hmm. our thought into creativity? Or why are aliens always humanoid, right? Because
correct.
It's the closest to what we can actually come up with as existing.
Correct.
I think also, though, it's not necessarily that we can think just of combinations. We can extrapolate like things. We can extrapolate abilities. Like, we can come up with superheroes. There's no man that can fly and move matter with his mind, but we can conceive of that.
Sure.
Because we're just extrapolating ability. So, and maybe you're going to get to this in your arguments.
I am.
Okay. I'll stop.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
That's going to be the argument from a secular perspective, is that God is simply an extrapolation of the archetype of the perfect man or woman or human.
Right. That's going to be one of the primary objections.
Okay.
And yet, this goes back to the, is essentially, my students will refer to this as the unicorn argument, right? Unicorns don't exist, and yet I can think about them, right? My daughter has like 1,000 of them. But a unicorn is nothing more than what?
A horse with a horn,
two things which previously exist. Anselm's argument is going to be that this goes beyond simple extrapolation, right? So this is the end of his quote. If that which nothing greater can be conceived not to exist, it is not that which nothing greater can be conceived. And this is an irreconcilable contradiction. There is then so truly a being that which nothing greater can be conceived to exist that it cannot even be conceived to not exist. And this being thou art, O Lord, our God. Okay? So Anselm is going to say this. This conception is not an extrapolation of a variety of attributes to their fullest degree. The conception is that there's an end to the road. Yes? Because human experience should dictate that what? There is no end. And yet, the idea of an end, the idea of a greatest, does exist. So for Anselm, if the idea exists of an ultimate being, that being must exist. Okay? Everybody there? What do you think? Does it hold water? Mm-hmm.
Something that is the greatest thing.
Mm-hmm.
That there is some end. I guess that it holds water to that end, I guess.
Right. And to that point, this argument only works if you agree on point number one, right? If you challenge one of the premises, the argument does not hold water, right? So if we challenge a definition of God, this does not hold water. Is everybody with me? Okay.
Where is good and evil?
Yeah. What do you mean by this? Like the greatest of all possible good type of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is where...
How do we define greatest?
Yeah. Anselm's going to ignore it because in his mind, Augustine's already done it for him. Okay. Right? Augustine is going to famously say evil does not exist, right? In both Confessions and in City of God, Augustine's going to say evil is not a thing. By the word evil, what we actually mean is a privation of good, right? That the more evil something is, the more further away from perfect goodness it is. So for Augustine, he's going to say the only way to measure the goodness of an action is to measure it against a perfect good. Does that make sense? And so Anselm would then say, look, I'm by the word God, I mean the greatest of all possible good.
So it must be good.
Right. Yeah, so for Anselm, and by the way, this is the trajectory of most of Western theology. We're going to reject the idea that evil is in and of itself a thing. The lack of goodness is what we mean by the word evil. So it's not to suggest that what we colloquially say is evil and suffering is not real. Evil and suffering is real. But what we mean by the word evil is a lack of goodness. I can't have evil without good, right?
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why is there just one greatest?
Who's got an answer to that? Anybody?
Would there have to be one that's better than all of them?
I mean, you even see the Greeks struggle with that, right? Like in the Titans versus Zeus. Who's better? Right? They even struggled with the concept of who's the greatest of all those gods, right?
Yeah.
Because to some degree Zeus was the ruler, to some degree he wasn't.
Right.
That's what I was going to say, because you can think of a greatest of all.
Mm-hmm. therefore there has to be one. Also the plot of the movie Hercules.
The Disney.
Yeah, the Disney one. Is there another one that I'm unaware of? We'll just ignore other things. Yeah.
This is a bit further in history, but I cannot get these thoughts away from my head. Descartes' famous ontological statement, I think, therefore I am. Mm-hmm. And him using that to prove ontology, to prove existence.
Correct.
But I always thought that he was getting ahead of himself even then, because all you have proven is that thinking exists.
Correct.
And this is kind of the same thing. You know, all you're proving is that thinking exists, that human beings are capable of thinking about X, Y, and Z. That doesn't necessarily prove that there is such a being or so on and so forth, right?
Yes and no. Yes and no. So here's some philosophy you didn't sign up for. When Descartes saying, I think, therefore I am, right? That is the big shift from a God-centric understanding of knowledge and truth to a human-centric understanding of truth, right? So before, right, the Enlightenment, before modernism kind of gets on its way and man is the center of the universe and the greatest of all things, the idea was that truth and knowledge disseminated from God to man. Descartes's going to say, no, the simplest form of truth I can know is that I exist because I think. Yes? Everybody with me? Okay. So Anselm was going to make a very similar argument to Descartes. He's going to beat him by a few centuries, right? But he makes the simpler argument of, I think, therefore God is. It's what we're doing. We're just not breaking it up into a different kind of syllogism like Descartes does. Descartes was more of the opinion that it is simpler to know that I exist than God exists. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Right.
To me, they're tied.
Correct. Anselm would agree with you.
"Quote unquote," prove is that human beings are capable of thinking.
Right.
In the one case, the very idea of existence can be proven because I'm thinking. In the
correct.
Other case, the existence of God is proven through thinking, but in the end, all you have proven to me, if I'm going to be really, really strict, is that human beings are capable of thinking.
Right. So then both Anselm and Descartes would ask the question, all right, what is the consequence of human thought?
Exactly.
Right.
And
so
that's where I am.
Anselm would, I think if you combine them both, the consequence of human thought is simultaneously I exist and God exists.
Mm-hmm. But through their syllogism, all mm-hmm. that has been proven ultimately is that thinking.
And for Anselm, that's enough to prove that God exists.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, if I can prove that humans think.
I'm talking about for us, right?
Sure.
Do we think this argument holds water, was your question?
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, no.
Because all it proves is that humans think.
That thinking.
What do y'all think? Yeah?
I'm stuck between number two and jumping to number four. It's in my mind, okay, if we change the word God to like a machine that can eradicate cancer if you walk through it.
Mm-hmm. Correct. By the way, this is the first major objection to be articulated in written word of Anselm. It's by a monk named Gaunilo, who famously talks about a perfect island. Right? So he's going to say, the greatest of all possible islands, the idea of the perfect island exists in my mind. I can't then say that that island exists, right? Right, and the difference would be, Anselm would look at you, Gaunilo would say, that's correct, that's why the argument doesn't make sense. Anselm would look back at you and say, but you're missing the greatest of all things. That's the difference. If I'm thinking about a cancer-curing machine, while it would be awesome if I thought it existed, you're not thinking about the greatest of all possible existence, and that's different. It's a different style of thought. Correct.
Correct. Because a perfect island can't actually do the things that God could necessarily the greatest of all capabilities, right?
Correct. And famously, Gaunilo is going to also say, are you really suggesting that everybody thinks the same thing about God?
Well, it seems to me if it's an argument, it should hold true whether you substitute God for any other something. The argument should flow.
Exactly.
Well, except that if you substitute God for any other thing, then you're just pulling on things you already know. Like, where do you get the idea of an island? Because it's already made. Where do you get the idea of a cancer-curing machine? Because cancer already exists. Machines already exist. You're not getting, I think what you're saying with Anselm is, you're not getting to the greatest thing. You're not getting to the end of the line. You're still conceiving from other things that you're coming from.
Then we shouldn't need an argument at all.
Problematically, this corresponds with truth. How do you get your cancer machine? Somebody decides that it's buildable. Does it exist? No. Why do they decide that it is buildable? They just do. What happens? They try to build it. Do they succeed? Maybe. Does somebody else succeed? Maybe. Maybe not. Does somebody eventually succeed? Yes. I can introduce them to you. They'll eventually be successful. You should talk to them. But the problem is that, and this is a huge problem for us in the modern day, this cracked open the door for the I think, therefore, it is. And that's where we live today, is these sort of self-actualized people who are like, I'm creating a cancer machine, that's what I'm doing, because I just thought it, and therefore it will exist because I said so. So it's problematically correspondent with everything around you at all times. And there's a huge coterie of human beings that believe this with everything in their beings, but they erase that very first thing before the equal sign and put cancer machines or startups or perfect islands or
right. Whatever. So that's so.
Manifesting.
Mm-hmm. What you said.
It's a what?
No. Right. Good.
No, you're good. Right. So if. If I may walk you through why we're going to go through three major objections. You cannot, and this is the key for any sort of argumentation, you cannot simply argue against the conclusion. Does that make sense? I don't go against this argument quibbling with the conclusion. I must disprove one of the premises in order to invalidate the conclusion. Everybody with me so far? This is where, just kind of in common parlance, most argumentation falls short. And why we just yell louder and louder and louder, you're wrong, is because we're quibbling about the conclusions. You can't do that in argumentation. Gaunilo goes after premise number one. Aquinas is going to reject premise number two. So our man Aquinas, who gave the five proofs of God famously, he's going to say that mental existence is not the same as actual existence. So he's going to agree with Gaunilo. Right, that not everyone conceives of God in the same way, and therefore this argument is worthless. Aquinas will admit, by the way, that if everyone did conceive of God the same way, that this argument's great. He's going to quibble with everyone conceiving of God in the same way. Anselm will look at him and say, well, then you're just conceiving of God incorrectly, and we're back into the murky waters of philosophy. He's going to say, all right, look, mental existence is not the same as actual existence. I'm going to quibble with premise number two here. Aquinas is going to try to make an argument that you can think about things that don't exist. I will be forthright and honest with you. Aquinas fails. He tried. God bless him. He tried. And I love Thomas Aquinas. But his argument about being able to think about that which does not exist, it becomes a circular argument. Okay? I do think he's got a point about mental existence, physical existence not being the same. Kant, Immanuel Kant, is going to quibble with premise number three, and this is the other major rejection of the ontological argument. Kant's going to say, how could you possibly prove that existence is greater than non-existence if you haven't experienced both? Obviously, that's a problematic assertion in the first place, because you wouldn't be aware of experiencing non-existence, yes? But Kant's going to say there is no way to know for sure that premise number three is correct. There's no way. Kant's got a point. I'll quibble with Kant on moral philosophy, but the idea of not being able to prove that existence is better than non-existence, he's got a point, right? Okay, so we've got rejections of premise one, Galileo, Island. Premise two, Aquinas, the idea of mental existence, actual existence being different. And then quibble with premise number three by Kant. There's no way to prove that existence is greater than non-existence. Okay. Do any of the rejections hold water? And this is where the ontological argument gets interesting. Do the objections, the quibbling with premise one, two, or three, do they hold philosophical, ontological water?
What was Aquinas' objection to number two?
So he's going to say mental existence, actual existence are two separate forms of existence.
Think about to say that therefore we're saying that there's nothing else, nothing exists outside of what we're constrained to even think about. I guess then I agree with him. I mean that.
Do you agree with Aquinas or Anselm?
I mean, I'm obviously coming from a biased perspective. Of something doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And so I would go with Aquinas. I would align more with Aquinas as an objection.
Anybody else? All three of you spoke at once.
But going back to the unicorn, anything we're going to imagine comes from something we already know.
Correct.
So to me, that. Does hold water. The idea of, I mean, I don't understand it, but I mean, I think I believe it. I hadn't thought about it before, but I'm sitting here trying to imagine something, and everything I imagine is a combination of things that I already know exist. I can't think of something that doesn't already exist.
Yeah, Plantinga's famous example of this. Alvin Plantinga, by the way, is kind of the champion of the ontological argument. He was the chair of the philosophy department at Notre Dame. In my mind, the second greatest theologian of the last 100 years. Like, he's a big deal. Plantinga is going to say, think of a brand new color. That's where he starts.
The combination of colors you already
it has to be. Right.
Well, and we talk about somebody being insane when it doesn't, when they're, I mean, that's why I'm thinking, my idea, and somebody who's not connected, well, I'm claiming to be hinged, but somebody who's unhinged, then it, but even then, do they think of something that's outside of some reality?
I mean, even if you're thinking of an alien, if you're putting together ideas that you...
Correct. I'm putting legs, I'm putting arms, I'm putting a head, something like that. Right. Yeah.
Does anyone here remember the way in which Isaac Newton described gravitational pull? Because I'm thinking that came out of... Where did that come from? You know... Yeah, but the description is there's an energy or there's something that's pulling on it. It's invisible. I can't describe it necessarily, but I can observe something that's happening in the world. So that's a potentially an example of something that came up to a human's mind that there's nothing that they know concrete that would explain it. So that would be like the human mind reaching way out there to describe something that's happening in reality,
sure,
theoretically, without really having anything to compare it to.
This, right? So, yeah, this is an interesting example because Newton actually buys the argument. Famously, he's going to agree with Anselm. What is the difference between studying the effects of gravity and thinking about the existence of a greatest possible being?
The effects of gravity are a mathematical exercise. That's an
Yeah, but that's why my question was, do you remember how to describe you know, what kind of words did he use to describe the thing itself that is exerting power over this thing?
But what he says, but what he concludes is not, it's not a power. It's, again, he gets to a mathematical exercise. He discovers that gravity is a property of mass, and he explains it in his second law, which is that force equals mass times acceleration. That's the basis of gravity, because gravity is a force. So he just explains it as
But have human beings talked about force, like invisible forces, before that?
Not in that kind of articulation. Right. But,
it's
yes.
It's a discovery of reality. I mean, it's again, it's a math, but that's a mathematical reality. That's just applying mathematics to what's already happening. Like gravity
becomes, existed before he figured it out.
Yes, but does anybody, maybe I'm having a hard time explaining this. I can observe what's happening in nature, which is what he did. And I can make measurements, and I can come up with the numbers and do the math and everything, right? I can explain, therefore, something that's happening on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But how do I explain what's actually happening that I don't see? Because if he is using language to try to describe what is actually happening in the world where I don't see, then it comes against this, right? Because somebody theoretically came up with an idea of something that's happening that you really cannot compare to anything. You cannot prove the existence of a force out there because nobody has ever seen such a thing, or nobody can describe such a thing. So it doesn't equate the theory of what might be happening behind the scenes, which we do not see, doesn't necessarily equate with something that's happening or can be described in reality.
It's easier to make your argument if you talk about abstract math, but there's an entire debate right now as to, is abstract math discovered like gravity was, which it's tough to make your argument talking about gravity because it's observable. And it's observable even on galactic scales. But if you're talking about abstract math and set theory and all this kind of crazy stuff that has no basis in observable reality, the problem is that there's a whole bunch of proofs that's merely a discovery exercise also.
The abstract math.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no such thing as conceiving something new. It's all discovery at all times.
Like where did gravity come from? Like it was already there. So all you're doing is explaining something.
You're articulating that which previously existed.
This is backing up to like asking the question, where did the gravity come from?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's what we're gonna do, because I'm getting glares from outside the door. Here's what we're gonna do. I want you to chew on it over the week. Chew on the argument. Come back, we'll revisit it next week. I'll push phenomenological argumentation one more week. If you would like to do further reading, I would heavily suggest the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. It's a free online tool. They do an excellent job explaining the ontological argument, explaining the objections, and explaining how the philosophy of both the argument and the objections work. Wikipedia does a terrible job. There's your warning. Wikipedia is atrocious at philosophy, famously. Go to Stanford. They're pretty smart over there. Second thing I'm going to say is this. Anselm bets, he actually says this in Proslogion, he's going to bet that the harder you think about this, the more you're going to believe it's true. So think about it over the course of the week.
How much is his bet?
Well, I'll tell you this, and this is an interesting facet of the argument. He wrote it in 1034, and no one's been able to conclusively prove he's wrong, ever. Because in order to prove this wrong, you must be thinking about that which he says you must be thinking about. Does that make sense?
I was yeah. going to say, when you were asking about old water, it at least gives everybody who interacts from Eric opposed to talk in circles.
Correct. That's the problem. Okay. We'll revisit it next week so we can get the next class in. Chew on it over the course of the week. I'll bring it up again. Goodbye.